From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
It's the last official day of the Florida legislative session, but lawmakers will have to return soon to tackle unfinished business. We'll discuss why.
They've really just had one of the most dysfunctional relationships between the two chambers that we've seen.
Also this week, changes are coming to Florida's primary food insecurity program known as SNAP.
It is a huge economic driver with over $6 billion in benefits flowing through the state's economy. It supports many retailers, particularly in rural communities.
We'll also delve into the positive side of aerial drones, and we'll check out the phenomena of micro schools. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and our end-of-the-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee and the 2026 Florida lawmaking session.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org.
Well, on this final official day of the Florida lawmaking session, I'm trying to find my hanky. Wait a second. It's in here somewhere. No, that's right. We won't need a hanky today, Tristan Wood, because...
They actually, believe it or not, are going to Sine Die today. They are doing the hanky, which is actually quite different from last year. Because, you know, last year it ran overtime because they didn't resolve the budget, they didn't sine-die, extended for several weeks. Today they are sine-dying, but they haven't finished a budget. They've committed to coming back in mid-April to actually finish the budget then before they're required to do so by July 1st.
The amazing thing to me, or I guess the more befuddling thing for me, is that this is not necessarily differences in policy amongst the various members of the Florida House and Senate and the governor's office. This seems to be more along the lines of just these folks can't get along.
I would say that there is some small policy differences. And like what I would say is, like last year and this year, the Senate President Ben Albritton is more comfortable spending a little bit more money. If you look at the Senate's budget proposal and the House's budget proposal that they were starting with at the start of negotiations, the Senate wants to spend about $1 billion more. Included in that is several of Albritton's several asks, like his rural renaissance program, where House Speaker Daniel Perez has wanted to like tighten the purse strings a lot, give more tax breaks with expanding different sales tax holidays, and cutting spending by, you know, about $1 billion. But a lot of it is, like you're saying, just a lot of political disagreement. It wasn't always that way, you know, when both of those legislative leaders were in their roles for the first time 2 years ago. Governor Ron DeSantis was pushing for a immigration special session where he was dictating the policy. And both Albritton and Perez were like, nope, we don't want that. They gaveled out his special session, called in their own, and passed policy that they were championing. And, you know, at that point, it seemed like, you know, these two political titans would get along. But since then, largely stemming from these budget disagreements and other issues, they've really just had one of the most dysfunctional relationships between the two chambers that we've seen, at least since Governor Ron DeSantis has been governor of Florida. It's been quite unusual, and it's been something that even you've seen State Senator Don Gates, you know, in our coverage area, him and other longtime legislators have called out how unusual and to them disappointing it is that it's kind of extended and been this back and forth.
Which leads us to the next question then. What did they accomplish in this final rush, knowing that they weren't going to have the budget ready by today? What else did they get done or conversely didn't get done this session?
I mean, there are several issues that are of tremendous importance that they agreed with. One of them is going to be kind of a continuation of the trend that the legislature has done over the past several years in targeting diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives. They passed a bill that's going to ban local governments across the state from having DEI offices, funding DEI programs and trainings, and giving money and support to events that are considered DEI. They got along on that. They got along on several other issues, and they had some where there was some disagreement, but they still passed some policy, right? A big topic that I've been following is kind of whether the state was going to regulate AI. President Donald Trump has, you know, come out and said that he believes that regulation of artificial intelligence should be done at the federal level. But some state lawmakers, particularly in the Florida Senate, wanted to pass an AI Bill of Rights that Governor Ron DeSantis was calling for, which would have protected name, image, and likeness rights, would have required parental permission for children to be interfacing with AI and to keep logs of what children are requesting on AI, would have banned chatbots from giving therapy and stuff like that. That passed the Senate, but it did die in the House, saying that they believe that type of regulation should be done at the federal level. But what they did agree on related to AI, and what they did ultimately pass over the past couple days here, is regulation around building these AI data centers, explicitly stating that local governments have the control of, for like zoning and permitting for these large-scale data centers that are controversial and being talked about all over the country, and that the people that create these data centers are responsible for the increased electricity prices and costs that would be accrued by bringing in these data centers. It also passes some other regulation related to water use, which is another controversial part of these data centers. That's, you know, one area, but there's still tons of other things. And, you know, we're recording this at like 2-3 p.m. in the afternoon on the final day of session. They're still meeting and going back and forth on several different bills. One bill I'm watching would make several changes to the 2023 Live Local Act. It seems like change has been passed that bill every single year, looking on, dealing with how do we take this big allocation of money and these tax incentives, looking to deal with housing problems in Florida. How do we take that and make it a reality? So they've been going back and forth on that bill and other issues, but overall, there are still several things that are expected to die and not be resolved.
Not everything will die. Some will live on. And we know that the budget has to be a come back and do it type of situation. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that's going to return them to Tallahassee for special sessions in the next couple, 3 months, Tristan?
The budget is a definite, but there's two other main outlying issues that will, at this point, all signs are pointing we're bringing them back. Already a congressional redistricting special session is going to be called. Governor Ron DeSantis put out an announcement related to it several weeks ago. So that is going to be happening. And that's related to kind of like this national tug of war between Republican and Democrat controlled states to redraw their lines ahead of the midterms. The other issue is the property tax issue. The Florida House tried to get their proposal passed this session, but the governor and the Senate want to deal with it in a special session. Separately, that is still likely to come. Every single Republican in the state holding executive office has been pushing it very hard, and it's been a big talking point in the Republican Party.
Florida lawmakers will be back. We will be back too. Tristan Wood, our Capitol reporter, as we wrap up the official 2026 Florida lawmaking session, but more to come. We'll see you, Tristan.
Thanks, Tom.
Coming up on Capitol Report, drones aren't always a deadly war weapon, as we're hearing in regards to the Iran war. It seems they also have some very useful civilian functions, like finding lost people.
Yeah, I was able to narrow definitely the search down to a particular area, and deputies were able to respond within seconds.
And the negative messages some kids receive in traditional schools has helped jumpstart the new trend of what are called micro schools.
The message they are receiving is this is not the place for you and that there's something wrong with you.
About 3 million Floridians receive benefits from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP. Legislation at the federal and state levels will impact these benefits for around 3 million participating Floridians. Sky Beard with No Kid Hungry Florida tells Gina Jordan the changes will impact eligibility for the program and the kind of food that can be purchased.
The purchasing guidelines are part of a waiver that Florida and approximately 25 or so other states have submitted to USDA, and that is changing and limiting what folks can purchase on SNAP with the intent of making sure that those funds are used to purchase as healthy foods as possible. So we will have limits in April for things like sodas and prepared desserts and other things that folks won't be able to purchase. So it's understandable, this attention on making sure that people have access to healthy foods. There's some practical and logistical challenges that come with implementing such restrictions. And we just want to make sure that families that are receiving SNAP are able to do so with dignity and the respect that they deserve, just as all shoppers deserve. And there are, as you mentioned, lots of conversations about work requirements and changes to some waivers that were previously available for certain folks that were on SNAP. And the Department of Children and Families is currently implementing those as those changes were required at the federal level as part of H.R. 1 or the Federal Reconciliation Bill back in July.
So that's a lot of people on SNAP benefits in Florida. What can you tell us about the impact of this program on Florida's economy?
Yeah, it is a large economic driver, not only addressing the important issue of food insecurity and making sure that kids and families and veterans and seniors have access to the food that they need to be healthy and support their families. But as you mentioned, it is a huge economic driver with over $6 billion in benefits flowing through the state's economy. It supports many retailers, particularly in rural communities. There aren't many food retailers in some areas of our state. And those that often are the sole or one of the few retailers, much of their revenue comes from the purchases made on EBT or SNAP cards. So it really does fuel many local businesses, many independent businesses, and that's a lot of dollars flowing through Florida's economy, again, spent at grocers, farmers markets, other places that accept EBT cards.
Let's address the Big Beautiful Bill's impact on costs to Florida for SNAP. So we're going to be spending more. Is that correct?
That's correct. There was a really historic changes made in the federal bill last July. It's interesting now that those happened back in July, but I think a lot of states are really just understanding or coming to realize what was included in that federal legislation and the impact that it will have on the state's economy. And that's true for SNAP. There were a couple changes made. One of them is related to the administrative cost to operate the SNAP program. It is very common in all federal programs that the state contributes a portion of that, and then the federal government pays some too. Usually that's a 50-50 cost share. In the federal bill, that cost is shifting, with more funding coming from states at 75% and 25% spent by the federal government. So for Florida, we're looking at an additional about $50.6 million that the state's going to have to find just to support the operation of SNAP. This is kind of the people that do that great work. The infrastructure, the technology at the Department of Children and Families is going to cost more for all states.
Yeah, that's no small amount.
Correct.
We heard Senator Gates talk about the state's error rate. Can you tell us what he means by that?
A lot of interest in error rates now. What changed in H.R. 1 is that error rates now are used as a way to determine how much a state will have to pay for the cost of the actual benefit. That has always and forever been 100% paid by the federal government. I think of it as if my family were to receive SNAP benefits and I go and I swipe my card at my local grocer, that swipe, the amount of the groceries, has always been federally funded. And that is changing. And that's significant. And that is all based on error rates. So the simplest way to think of an error rate is, you know, the accuracy of a state in determining SNAP benefits for families over a given period of time. And it can also be an over or under payment issue. So if my family were to receive $100 and it was determined I should have gotten $125 or I shouldn't have gotten maybe $85 a month, those are both considered in the error rates.
It sounds like no matter what happens, Florida will have to pay more for SNAP.
That is true. And that's true in the administrative cost increase and also in this benefits amount that states before never had to pay. The error rates are really the key to really looking at what Florida will have to pay. We don't know yet what the next error rates will be. We will know those in June. So we only know estimations, looking at historical information about error rates, mm-hmm. and being at a little over 15%, if that were to remain constant, Florida will be expected to pay about $1 billion a year in order to maintain SNAP benefits as they are currently in the state.
What about kids on SNAP? School lunches, for example, how might a big change in SNAP impact school lunches?
Yeah, it's a really good question because I think we think of changes to SNAP in a real, you know, way that is related to just the SNAP benefits, but it surely is more than that. In Florida, we have what's called a direct certification process, which is lovely for families who are managing the process of these benefit programs. And so if a family is eligible for SNAP, if they have school-age children, those children are automatically eligible for free or reduced meals at school, which makes that process a whole lot easier and provides access to food in schools as well. Mm-hmm. So we do worry that if there are declines in SNAP, then it also could impact access to school meals as well. And that would be incredibly difficult for families if they are challenged with food at home and also at school.
Yeah. What is the most urgent detail about SNAP changes that you think we should know?
I think it's really important that we all, including policymakers in Tallahassee and folks who are all across this state, really understand the value and the importance of the SNAP program. I think it's important that we recognize who receives SNAP. These are hardworking families with children who are doing everything they can to put food on the table. It's elderly folks, it's veterans, it's people who really just need some support. And so really thinking about who receives these benefits, the value of it, how important it is in our fight for food insecurity, and making sure we keep that in the forefront as we have continued difficult conversations.
Well, I know you're going to stay busy. Sky Beard, Florida Director for No Kid Hungry, thank you for the work you do.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That was WFSU Public Media's Gina Jordan speaking with No Kid Hungry Florida's Sky Beard. The U.S. has more than 400,000 certified remote pilots, according to the Federal Aviation Administration. More than 850,000 aerial drones are registered nationwide, and their use extends beyond personal enjoyment. WGCU's Jennifer Crawford tells us how the technology is being adapted beyond fighting crime in one Florida county.
What is she wearing?
She's wearing black socks and pants, green and white.
A 13-year-old girl reported as a runaway to the Collier County Sheriff's Office one evening in February.
How long ago did she leave?
About 10 minutes ago. She has long black hair.
Drone pilot Brian Barcello just wrapping up a drone training session when the call came in to help find the girl, last seen near a Naples area church.
So I immediately responded to the scene. It was not too far away. I met up with another drone pilot that was already on scene. We checked the wooded area, and we were using thermal at the time. So we were able to see some heat signatures. These were just animals, you know, rabbits and things like that, small cats. And then we kind of expanded the perimeter of our search. He went southbound, I went northbound. And as I approached the heat signature, I saw that heat signature go from a walking to a running stance. Once I got close enough, I switched over, I turned on the spotlight, switched over to our color monitor. And then I was able to identify her based on the clothing she was wearing.
Within about a half hour of deploying his drone, the girl was discovered unharmed.
It was very rewarding. Yeah, I was able to narrow definitely the search down to a particular area, and deputies were able to respond within seconds.
Sergeant Delianas Marrera supervises the Collier County Sheriff's Office drone unit. She says it's just one example of how drones are being used each day to protect and serve.
They assist with search and rescue. They are rapid deployable drones, and deputies have them on the field at all times, so they're ready to go.
The high-tech tools emerging as a powerful force, opening up lines of human connection, even promoting empathy and calm during times of crisis.
it's crucial because it de-escalates situations. So I've seen situations where a person has been in mental distress and the presence of a deputy has agitated that, but they could back up. The drone helped units on scene keep eyes on the person, but not agitating the situation. So we were able to talk to that person and communicate and de-escalate, negotiate with that person. The community remained safe, the deputies on scene remained safe, and the person in distress remained safe.
Billy Gessner is a drone pilot and tech manager for the Collier County Sheriff's Office Real-Time Operations Center.
We can clear rooms, we can clear vehicles, and we can provide observational awareness to responding deputies before they can get into harm's way. So if there is a barricaded subject in a house, we could actually send a drone inside the house to get a lay of the land before we even send an individual or a responding deputy inside the house. So that's for officer safety.
Gessner says Sheriff Kevin Rambosk expanded its drone unit almost twice the size of a year ago, purchasing 34 drones for almost $700,000. The majority of the cost, more than $450,000, paid for with a grant from the state of Florida.
Florida passed legislation that we are no longer allowed to use drones from countries of foreign concern. One of those is China that is made DJI products. So we are no longer allowed to use DJI. So we were afforded the opportunity by FDLE to return those drones to FDLE and then get funding from them to purchase new drones that are made here in America.
Gessner says they recently brought on new drone pilots.
We were just around 18 a few months ago, and we put out feelers to say, hey, do you want to join the drone unit? We had almost 30 people that wanted to join within a week. So we set them up to take the Part 107 exam, and we put them through a class. Everyone passed. Every single person that went to our class that took the exam passed the exam to become a pilot.
Some pilots taking the drones home with them as part of a drone call-out program.
And it's very important because our county is so large. Our county is 2,300 square miles. Yes, a lot of it is Everglades, but we do have a huge county, including Immokalee. So we want to make sure that we put drones in pilots' hands that can respond to calls in a timely manner. We've found missing elderly individuals face down in water. So it does save lives, not only officers' lives, but also the community's lives as well.
Eyes in the sky, giving boots on the ground life-saving information when minutes matter most.
That was WGCU's Jennifer Crawford reporting. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, school choice expansion in Florida in recent years has given parents more options for their kids. This has led to an increase in micro schools. WUSF's Delina Miller spent a recent day at one such school in Newport Richey, which bases many of its classes around nature.
It's shortly before 10 a.m. in the backyard of a small custard-colored bungalow nestled into an older West Pasco County neighborhood. For the past half hour, children between the ages of 5 and 10 have rolled in with their parents. 5-year-old Adam, who still hasn't tired of his blippy Halloween costume, makes a beeline for the new slide, his blue and orange cap and bow tie bouncing with his steps.
You're going to go down the new slide?
Yeah! Ahava Nature School is named for the Hebrew word for love. It's been open for less than 2 years, but it's already made an impact with the 14 children enrolled here, says school founder Chantel Excel.
We have our biggest regulator in front of us, which is the earth and nature. So we always like to start the day that way.
The nonprofit school has a waiting list. Most of the children are here on homeschool scholarships, and several are neurodivergent. They may fidget or struggle to sit still. That makes traditional public and private schooling difficult. Teachers there are not equipped to work one-on-one with them, and the kids are often chastised or even disciplined.
The message they're receiving is this is not the place for you and that there's something wrong with you.
Excel says Ahava has a small teacher-to-child ratio. It ensures each student is accommodated and encouraged. After the kids have burned off a little energy, she directs them to the living room of the house, where they all gather on the floor, crisscross applesauce, to talk about bees.
Does anyone know the purpose of a bee?
They pollinate
our food.
Yes.
And sometimes when they get scared, they sting you.
Yes.
Then they pivot into a quick lesson about counting change.
Okay, so
core lessons on math, English, and science are taught through hands-on play and activities and are adjusted appropriately for each child's age and level of understanding. Excel also considers their interests.
A particular child here is really into trains, so we brought somebody in who is a train expert. He was a train engineer, and they were able to learn all about that process.
Later in the morning, the group takes a leisurely half-mile walk to downtown Newport Richey. Excel stops to show the kids a natural beehive on a tree from a safe distance on the sidewalk.
Yeah, that's cool.
They keep walking. Along the way, they stop to pick up flowers and leaves they'll use to make stamps later.
Do you think these leaves would make a nice pattern?
Yeah.
Let's pick some.
Once downtown, the kids scatter to pick plants and climb trees. 11-year-old Hope sits down on a short boat dock along the Cody River and swirls a stick in the water. She says she looks forward to school every day now.
I get to see wildlife, and you can, see millipedes, lizards, birds.
She recently started at Ahava after some trouble in public school. Ahava, she says quietly, is different.
There's no bullies.
Afterward, teacher Charlotte's son directs them to raised garden beds in the backyard.
Team Ahava, answer me this. Why do we need to trim the plants?
So we can plant more.
So we can plant more. What are we going to plant?
Carrots.
Son passes out scissors, then leans down to the ground and gently grips a fistful of arugula.
And I'm just going to trim as close to the ground as possible.
8-year-old Madeline watches closely. Her mom, Michelle McLaren, says she cheers the start of the school week.
She can tell me, what vegetation this is. Can you eat that? You can eat this weed. Just really cool stuff like that. Obviously, they do core, but core is very different here. It's very play.
After their garden time, the kids dig through baskets of plants they collected on their walk. They brush paint onto the leaves and flowers and use them to stamp white tea towels.
It's okay if it's not perfect.
Tomorrow, they'll sell them at a nearby farmer's market. The rest of the afternoon is spent practicing their baking skills on pumpkin muffins. Founder Chantel Excel smiles as she watches nearby. The kids' eyes light up when they answer questions correctly.
I almost thought we were opening this little secret tiny space, and I had no idea that the need would be so great.
It's now close to 3 in the afternoon, and while the muffins bake, the kids pack up their backpacks. Adam, who hours ago discarded his blippy hat and orange plastic glasses, shoves them into his bag.
We'll see you on Wednesday, buddy.
Excel says with more community funding, they can hire more teachers and take on more students. She even dreams of opening a second location one day. I'm Daylena Miller in Tampa.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Jennifer Crawford and Daylena Miller. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Tim McGuire, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week, on air and online, for more reports from the state capitol.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.